Hello, this is another night of full moon, and we are back. Let's make it a night when we look up into the sky and we ask where we are from and how our universe works. This is Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle and bringing you the Metaphysical Podcast, Episode 2, The Field, The Force, and Schrödinger's Cat. Last time, if you tuned in with us, we were discussing what happened if we assumed a consciousness or mind-based paradigm. Because we are all quite familiar with looking at the universe that it is made of atoms and it is made of molecules. In other words, that it's based on matter. But we have seen last time that that is nothing but an assumption. So we can turn that assumption over and ask, what if we look at the world in a way that we assume it is based on mind or consciousness? And we saw that there is actually no scientific fact whatsoever that would prevent us to do so. But if we look at a universe from a mind or consciousness-based paradigm, then of course we have to ask ourselves, what kind of universe will we derive from that? We all know the universe that is derived from matter, because we live in one, don't we? So we all know that if science assumes that the world is based on matter, then we get things like cars and airplanes, and when we get nuclear energy and we get nuclear bombs and we get satellites and mobile phones and computers, and we get a useful utilitarian world we can live in. But what if we assume that the world is based on consciousness? Does that have any practical meaning? Can we use it in any way? And I would say if we assume that the world is based on consciousness, then we have to find some sort of indication for that. We know that in a matter-based universe, matter is actually organized. We know that because we look at a periodic system, it's been developed, and we can see that the atoms and the molecules that are making up our world, they form a kind of organized system. And we can derive our entire science from that organized system. But is consciousness organized at all? Can we find an organization behind the consciousness that might govern the universe? I mean, the information that we use in our everyday life is very well organized, isn't it? We have our emails and we have our text messages that we send through the ether in some way, and we have our websites and we have the entire internet that is a kind of organized informational system. But is life force energy organized? Is the universal energy that has created the world and that is running life, is that organized? Indeed, it seems that there is an informational system out there, because indigenous people and animal seem to be connected to it. I unconsciously and unknowingly tapped into it a long while ago. And it was back at a time when I was still a lawyer and ignored most of the mysterious aspects of the universe. But what happened was a very striking experience that I couldn't just brush away. And what happened was that one night I lay down in my bed. And as I lay there ready to get to sleep, I started to feel something that I can best describe as a tiny little bit of whirlwind kind of feeling and energy that was coming to my forehead, just where the eyebrows meet. And it felt as if something wanted to pierce through my skin. It was very, very strange. I tried to brush it off, but it kept coming back. And it kept coming back that night and some nights after that. And with my worldview at that time, I was actually thinking maybe I have some problem with my head, and I almost went to the doctor because the sensation was so strong that it started to be painful. But a part of me felt, no, this is not something that comes from my head. It comes from outside and it is a new experience. And I couldn't just make it go away. And interestingly enough, at the same time, I was starting to feel really unhappy about the fact that I was a lawyer, and I started to re-question my entire life. It literally felt that I'm in the wrong profession. My interest in the nature of the human mind was so strong at that time that I felt I needed a kind of escape route from the profession that I was in at the moment. And what I found was a professor, Professor Zips at the University of Vienna, who was studying a subject quite peculiar, which is legal anthropology. So he studied the legal systems of indigenous people. And I thought that's already more interesting than what I'm doing at the moment. And I asked him whether I could work with him. And he said yes. So I ended up doing a PhD with him. And I ended up being in this magic world of anthropology for a while, which was very, very useful. And I heard about shamans and I heard about indigenous people using altered states of consciousness. And I was told that even the earliest art in the world, if you look at cave paintings all around, they depict scenes that are actually coming from trance experiences. So modern subjects who experience trance, they see things that are identical in their symbolic to what you can see in these ancient cave paintings. So it seemed that there is something inherent in the human psyche and in human nature that wants to explore beyond the reality that we know in everyday life. And as part of that work that I was doing at that time, I went to South Africa and I was doing a work about a South African bushman. And at that time, I traveled to South Africa and there was a lawyer who told me all I needed to know for my interview. And at the end, he said, "I want to tell you something, but don't quote me on it. Don't put it into your legal work." So I promised not to quote him. Therefore, I can't tell you his name right now either. But what he said was that he was working as a lawyer with the Bushmen. And he went out into the bush and also became quite friends with them. So they showed him a lot of things about their lifestyle. And one of the things that they showed him was how they go hunting. And when they were out hunting, he noticed something peculiar, namely that these indigenous people seemed to know when animals were hiding behind a bush without seeing them. So they knew in advance that this is going to be the bush where the animal is hiding. And he asked them, "How do you know? I can't see these animals. Can you see them?" And they said, "No, we can't." "Can you smell them?" They said, "No, we can't." So he asked, "How do you know that the thing is behind the bush?" And that's when I got my first answer to that peculiar feeling in the middle of my forehead that I got at night. Because the bushman said that when they are walking towards a bush and there is an animal behind it, then the middle of their forehead, in between their eyebrows, starts to vibrate. So I thought, how interesting is that, that I have this experience, and then the Bushmen in Africa are actually using that for something. And I still didn't know what I can use it for, but it seemed to be related to some kind of information system. And I promised this lawyer I'm not going to quote his name, but there is a name I can actually quote, because Laurens van der Post is a Dutch traveler who describes something similar about the Bushmen. He was also hunting with them and they made a very successful hunt, and he said his car was full of meat and they were going back to the village. And he said to the Bushmen, "Oh, your families are going to really be really happy that there is so much meat, right?" And the Bushmen told him, "They already know." And true enough, while they were walking towards or driving towards their village, the people were already singing and celebrating the hunt. So he asked, "How do you know?" And they said, "We have a wire system." And they were pointing towards their chest, actually, this time. And they were saying, "We have a wire system that works like your kind of telegraphs. We know when something is happening to the loved ones, because we have an informational system that you guys already forgot." So there seemed to be more and more evidence for some kind of informational system that we, as modern humans, lost contact with. The interesting thing that I've heard next was that on December 26th of 2004, we all remember it was one of the deadliest natural disasters of our century, when the tsunami hit in Southeast Asia. And we know that all our 21st century warning systems totally failed, and we had 230,000 people dying in 14 different countries. But anthropologists went to a place in India, to the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, where five different groups of indigenous people live. And they're very interesting in their lifestyle because they haven't changed the way they live in 70,000 years. So basically, they are Stone Age people. They have the Stone Age civilization in the present time. And what happened to them during the tsunami was that they seemed to know in advance, and they left. They evacuated their places before the tsunami hit, and they escaped the tragedy. And there was a lawyer, and that lawyer wasn't shy to say it out loud. His name is Ashish Roy. And he actually said afterwards that they, the indigenous people of those islands, have a sixth sense which we do not possess. And also, after the same tsunami, there was an interesting piece of news everywhere in the media claiming that while so many people died, there were virtually no corpses of wild animals found. So there was one national park in Sri Lanka where they found no dead animal. They seemed to all somehow tapping into what's coming and leaving the dangerous zone. Okay, but if there is an informational system that indigenous people and animals can tap into, what about us? What about civilized people? Did we completely lose the connection to it? And interestingly enough, it seems to be that we didn't, because there is one particular time in our lives, or shall I say in our death, when it's very well documented that most people seem to tap into information that is beyond the brain. And I'm talking about those millions of cases of near-death experiences that I mentioned in a previous podcast. Because most of the people who come back from a clinical death experience, they report that they had a what they call a panoramic life review. So they float out of their body. They feel that they are pure consciousness. And some of them go through a tunnel. Some of them meet a light being or even their own relatives. But what a lot of them report is that they get a sense of life beyond space and time, in which they get an instantaneous review of their entire life. So as if it would be happening at the same time, but they get a memory from the first moment of their lives to the end, when they don't just see the information, but they also feel like they are reliving it. And they are not just reliving the actual experiences, but they seem to know what kind of effect everything that they did had on the people they interacted with. So sometimes events that seem to be very minor and not very important during their lives, they become extremely important. And events that might have sounded very important just lose their significance. So I remember reading the account of a lady who had this panoramic life review, and she said she remembered being in a supermarket where there was a little girl who lost her mother. And she picked up a little girl and she comforted her. And then within 3-4 minutes, they found the mother and she gave the kid back to the mother. And it seemed in that moment of her death that this was one of the most important things in her life, because she saw the consequences of her action. And she also saw the consequences of what would have happened if she didn't find that child, because something bad would have happened in that case. So it was a domino effect. It was something that turned out to be utterly significant. But the reason why I'm bringing up these examples at the moment is because it also shows that there is some kind of memory that we can tap into in that moment of death. So what is this memory? And that could be a same kind of organized informational system that is out there. And it's very hard to find theories or even hints at what that can be. If we go back into legend, then there is a ancient Indian legend that says that thousands of years ago, humans could tap into divine intelligence and write down what is then later recorded in palm leaves libraries, and that is the lives of people that are going to be born. So legend has it that if you go to India and you are meant to find your palm leaves, that then there is a library that contains all information about your life, including the names of your parents, including your birthplace, your birth date, and not just what happens to you in your life, but also the karmic patterns that are in your life. And I remember that back then when I started my exploration, and when I was still a lawyer, I picked up a book like that. It was about a woman who went to India, and she heard about these palm leaf libraries, and she thought, I'm going to check this out. I think she was a journalist, and she said, I will go there and I will find my palm leaf. And I was very skeptical, of course, but at the same time very fascinated by the idea. And I went into my office, and there was a colleague of mine who was an Austrian lady lawyer, but she came from India. Her family came from India. So I thought I'd ask her. I said, Mira, have you heard of those palm leaf libraries in India? She said, oh, yeah, something. And so we discussed that. I said, do you believe in that? And the answer that she gave to me was totally remarkable, because she said to me, well, here in Vienna, I don't believe in it. But when I go to India, yes, I do. In India, very magical things can happen. And that answer came from a very rational person. And I think at the same time, that answer was quite accurate, because it kind of like expresses the truth. Because if we look at these kind of stories from our scientific rational paradigm, then we probably don't believe in that. But if we look at it from a consciousness paradigm, then we can ask ourselves, maybe there is something in legend that touches upon the truth. And this idea that there is a kind of library, that there is a kind of system of information that is accessible for all eternity, and that contains all our lives and everything that ever happened in the universe, is something that came from India, but it also reached Europe, because the different mystical thinkers, mainly the Rudolf Steiner and the Anthroposophical school, they brought this idea to Europe, and they started calling the Akashic records. And these Akashic records are that basic idea that there actually is an organized system of information out there. And today, it's Rupert Sheldrake, for example, in biology, who does promote this idea that there is an inherent memory in nature. He says that the way, for example, species evolve, it can't just be accounted for in terms of Darwinian evolution. There has to be some kind of other informational system that he explains with morphogenetic fields. There are fields of information that grow when new information is experienced and new information is uploaded into that system, so to speak. So because of these morphogenetic fields, if a generation of a species, for example, learns something, then that learning becomes accessible to future generations. And that is something that Darwinian evolution says is impossible genetically. But interestingly enough, there seems to be some experimental evidence for that. And it goes back to 1920, where there was an experiment at Harvard University done by William McDougall. And this experiment was actually conducted in hope of studying the Lamarckian inheritance. So that is the kind of inheritance theory that allows for learned experience to be inherited. But it was disputed, it is still disputed, it is not mainstream. So they did some experiments on that, whether that can be proven or disproven. And as a result of these experiments, something weird came up. Namely, what they did was they had generations of, I believe, rats and they were put in an underwater tank, and there was a system of how to escape that underwater tank, and they were supposed to learn that escape route. And if they managed, then they were rewarded, and if they didn't manage, then they were like punished with something. And the way the experiment was conducted is that they measured how many errors they made before they learned the escape route. And what they found out, that future generations of rats learn the escape route faster. And not just within the same lab, but also they did the same experiment later in at Edinburgh University and at Melbourne University. And those completely unrelated and, you know, geographically far away generations of rats, they learned it so quickly that some of them didn't even commit any errors. So it seemed that there was some kind of way for them to access the information that they needed to find the escape route, that there is some kind of actual database of learning that was available to future generations of rats. And the interesting thing about all that is that in our present paradigm, we say that memory is stored in the brain. And solely in the brain. I don't think that any of us would seriously dispute that brain has to do a lot with memory and has to do a lot with thinking. But the question is the brain exclusively responsible for memory and for processing information? And there seems to be at least one experiment which I found and which is truly remarkable that shows that there must be something else. It can't just be the brain. So there is one interesting experiment that suggests that memory is not necessarily stored in brain or brain structures exclusively. And that experiment has been done in Washington, D.C. at Georgetown University, where they took caterpillars and they taught caterpillars a certain behavioral pattern, which you can do. You can train caterpillars like other animals by giving them rewards and punishments. So they learned a certain behavior, and then these caterpillars went through the metamorphosis process where the entire brain gets dissolved, including all the other tissues of the caterpillar body. And after the caterpillars went through the metamorphosis process, the interesting thing was that the moth still remembered everything that they learned as caterpillars. So how can all these things make sense? How can it make sense that indigenous people and animals receive information that we don't know where it comes from? How can we explain that people are dying and they have information about their entire life? How can we explain that moths remember what caterpillars learned? How can we explain that subsequent generations of rats remember what other rats learned on the other side of the world, and so on and so on? I will not attempt to give an answer and a theory to that because I don't know. But it seems that there is a new paradigm around it evolving. And Ervin Laszlo, a scientist of a new paradigm, he actually, in honor of the ancient Akashic traditions, he was suggesting to call this field the Akashic field. And he bases a theory on that, where the world is organized as information. For us in the West, a field of information can sound exotic, but actually this field is known to very many cultures, and it's known not just as a field of information, but as a field of universal life force energy itself. And if we go all around the world, then we realize that most people have a name for it. It's what the Chinese call qi, what the Japanese call ki, what the Hindu tradition calls prana, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition calls lung, and even in the European, in the ancient Greek European tradition, the Stoic philosophers called it pneuma. or in Hawaii, they call it mana, and that is a word that is known in many dozen Pacific languages. And this universal life force energy is perhaps best known throughout the world for its healing qualities. And I remember once I read the account of an American doctor called David Eisenberg, who went to China and was working together with some Chinese doctors. And he described the different healing methods that were based on using the qi energy. And he describes in his book how Chinese doctors use the internal qi, moving of the internal life force energy to heal, even healing psychiatric disorders. He says that Chinese people are more happy to work with the qi than talk about their subconscious and about their dreams. And he also describes quite magic-looking phenomena. He says that some practitioners also are able to externalize that qi, and they can do miraculous things, or seemingly miraculous things, like lighting up light bulbs with it. And that was something I read in a book, and I couldn't decide whether there is any truth or not to it. So today I invited Joanna Whitehurst to our podcast, who is a Reiki master and who works with this energy herself. So I thought of inviting her and ask her what she thinks of this universal life force energy. So, Joanna, what can you tell us? Can we actually see this energy in action?
Well, we can see it. It's used in martial arts and also people walking on coals. They Right. can direct the energy in the body to form a protective barrier. So when in martial arts people are karate chopping pieces of wood or blocks,
All right.
they can direct that energy to the point in the body to make it stronger so that they don't get hurt. And when people are walking on hot coals, and Western people do that as well. It's become quite a trend that people do to raise money for charity. Mm. And it's they can direct the energy to their feet so that their feet don't get burnt.
That's very interesting. Is it something that you need a special gift for, or is it something that anyone can learn?
Anyone can learn it.
Really?
Yeah. It's a natural ability that we all have. We've just forgotten how to access it. And in the Reiki training, you get tuned back into that energy and the ability to access it.
How did you learn it? How did you come in contact with it?
Well, my mum actually is a Reiki master herself. So I was exposed to it at quite a young age. But my feeling at the time was I didn't want anything to do with it. It was too freaky and too way out.
So even if you grew up with it, like your mother is doing it, but if you're in the Western culture, you still feel like it's something weird?
Yes, it was not something anyone else was doing. My friends weren't.
Yes.
My friends' mums weren't doing that
yes.
kind of thing. So how I got into it myself, as I got older, I suffered from a bad neck.
Right.
And my mum gave me Reiki. And the Reiki clicked the bones without her manipulating my neck at all. The bones in my neck restructured so that I didn't need to go to the osteopath anymore.
Did you feel anything when she was doing it to you?
Yes, it released off. It felt like I'd been to the osteopath without having to go.
Oh, interesting. And when you're using it, what are you actually doing?
We're channeling the energy of the life force energy through us. So as a Reiki master, I channel the energy through me. It's directed by what we call our intuition or our higher self, our soul. There are lots of names for it.
Yes.
So it's a more advanced form of healing because I'm not doing it myself. It literally is channeling through me. And the higher self has a higher perspective. We can see, the higher self can see what I can't see,
Yeah, it's quite interesting that you're saying that, because it's, again, the information aspect is coming in,
yes,
right? So that it's not just an energy, but it's also maybe a kind of information that is organized. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I think so. I believe so. The energy, the information can be accessed by my higher self. I'm tuning into that information at a higher level that I'm not, I can't access from my level.
So where does Reiki come from? It's Japanese, isn't it?
Yes, it comes from Japan. In Japan, Reiki has been practiced for thousands of years. Mm. And in fact, all hands-on forms of healing in Japan were called Reiki. Mm. It's, Reiki itself stands for, the meaning of Reiki itself, the word Reiki, stands for spiritually directed life force energy. Mm. As in, that's the basic meaning of the word. But the what we know in the West as Reiki was founded by someone called Mikeo Usui. Mm-hmm. And he found a really easy way of passing it on to his students.
Yeah.
And his intention was to spread mm-hmm. it throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, has happened.
How did he find it?
Well, he actually, the information that we have about Mikeo Usui, there's a lot more information come to light recently because mm-hmm. a lot more people are interested.
Yes.
And I have researched some of that information. So he, the story goes that he set out to find enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And he was a Tendai Buddhist monk. He also practiced other forms of religion. He studied them. And he spent his life, or the majority of his life, searching for enlightenment. And he couldn't find it. In the last few years before he found Reiki, he was a Zen Buddhist. He was learning with the Zen Buddhists. And one of them told him to go up a spiritual mountain in Japan and experience death. Mm. He was so fed up with his life, he thought, right, why not? Because he hadn't found this enlightenment. So he went up the spiritual mountain and he fasted. Mm. It was about 14 or 15 days through, maybe more than that, that he hadn't eaten anything.
Yes.
So he was either going to die or come back enlightened. Yes. But he did. He had an enlightened experience. It's described as a light coming down from above. And he understood all the learning that he'd gone through, all the different religions, all his studying he'd done to find enlightenment, all fell into place for him. And he understood how the energy works, how it could be passed on, what it could be used for. He really had an aha moment and an enlightenment. So he rushed down, the story goes that he rushed down the hill to spread the good news that he'd found this enlightenment. And he tripped over and badly hurt his foot. Mm. And he put his hands on his foot and his foot was healed. And that was just because of his thinking. He wanted his foot healed. So he really found that he could use it for much more and get much more practical use out of his understanding.
So he wasn't even expecting that result.
He wasn't expecting that result. Mm. That's the story. But of course, Reiki itself has been practiced in Japan for thousands of years.
Yes.
So it's my belief that he understood that we can heal with this energy as well as enhance our spiritual abilities, get in touch with our psychic nature. And it's what we call raising our vibration.
Yes. And he began teaching it.
He began teaching it to others.
How do you teach it today? Or how do people learn it today?
Today, it's a very simple experience. Anyone can go through it. We have what's called attunements. Now, these attunements are a small ritual, and they are based on Buddhism and various aspects of Mikeo Usui's background. And all rituals are understood now to take on the power of every time they've ever been used.
Yeah.
And the ritual strengthens our intention. So Reiki is passed on from person to person, from a Reiki master teacher, to a student, using these rituals as a strengthening of the intention for it to be passed on and for the student strengthening their intention to receive it.
So every time someone uses the system, they add to the field of information.
That's right, yes.
It does sound like all the experiments I was talking about, doesn't it?
Yes.
So there is a field out there that we can add to.
Yes.
And if we look at the world differently and we have a personal experience, that experience can add to it, can't
yes.
it?
Yes, and it's strengthened, enhanced, yes.
Fascinating. So I'm finding this especially interesting because it points towards a system where we can form our intention that directs the energy, and then that energy is actually influencing the physical reality, in your case, people's health.
Yes.
Actually, in the 1920s, this was a brand new idea, and it came up in physics through the Schrödinger's cat experiment, which is a experiment in thoughts. So no cat is actually involved and no cat gets killed in the process. But the setup is as follows. You imagine a container that holds a cat, but it also holds some deadly device that can kill the cat. And randomly, this device is turned on. So you have a 50% chance that when you open that device, the box, the cat is going to come out alive, and you have 50% chance that a cat is going to be dead. But again, it's a thought experiment. It's not happening with real cats. But what the physicists wanted to know in the 1920s is, how can we precisely describe the state of the cat before any measurements are done? Simply meaning before anyone observes what's going on, before anyone opens the box. And they found that in order to have a consistent and logical answer, they had to introduce two new concepts that were necessary and that were previously unknown in physics. The first concept was that the state of the cat is in a superposition because it can only be described by the sentence or the statement, the cat is alive, plus the statement, the cat is dead. So you need the sum of both of these statements together to correctly describe the state of the cat. And only, this is the second and the most interesting thing, only when a human being, an observer, goes and opens the box, does this superposition collapse into one single state. And only then you can say the cat is either alive or the cat is dead. What that philosophically implies is that there is a crucial role of the observer. Before there is an observer, the cat is in a different position. So this changes the paradigm quite significantly, because before that, in classical physics and science, scientists always assumed that there was an objective reality out there that they had to describe, measure, find out its laws. But now it seems that there is a universe out there that we influence. We influence it through observation. As you said, in Reiki, we influence it through our intention, because if we change our intention, we change those energies that set certain processes in motion that can lead to healing, like in Reiki. And what else can they lead to? They probably can lead to all sorts of changes in the material world. And if we establish that way of thinking, then it becomes clear that whatever is happening inside our mind, our thoughts themselves have or must have a kind of creative power. And I will invite you back for next month when the full moon is up again to explore that question with us. Is it true? Is it really true that our thoughts have creative power? In the meantime, I thank Joanna very much for coming here today. I thank you very much for listening and stay in tune. This was Metaphysical Podcast episode 2, The Field, the Force, and Schrödinger's Cat. Thank you for listening.